So why do we insert third-party beneficiary clauses everywhere? Because they just are there, and we think we're supposed to, and we're afraid to take them out. And so I'm not even suggesting we take them out. I'm suggesting we read them. We look at the rest of our contract and think, well, wait a minute. Are there third-party beneficiaries that we are intending to benefit by this contract? Oops, maybe some of our officers and directors, maybe some of our affiliates, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And here's the problem. The recent Delaware case, just handed down in June, Dolan versus Altice, is sort of the latest example of this, of the problem where you actually have an intended third-party beneficiary in your document that was supposed to get some benefits from the contract. In this case, it was a shareholder who specifically bargained for a provision that was intended to keep a certain, I think it was television station, operating for a certain period of time without change. It was very important to that person, and it was argued that that was the basis upon which they agreed to approve the deal. But that party was, that shareholder was not a party to the merger agreement, only the company was. And so then, at the back of the contract, there was a provision that says there are no third-party beneficiaries, and it did not carve out this particular clause. And so the court said, Section 6.4F, which was the provision that gave specific third-party beneficiary rights to this shareholder, or gave had a provision that was in that shareholder's favor, is specific in providing detailed rights that expressly benefit non-parties to the contract. Section 9.8, which was the no third-party beneficiary clause, is specific in identifying who is and who is not intended to be a third-party beneficiary of the contract. Canons of contract construction alone cannot render unambiguous, too specific, and yet conflicting contractual provisions. So now, instead of a So now we have a trial. The case ended up settling, and so this was this. I don't know. I actually don't know exactly what happened, but I assume that there was some settlement along the lines of providing some benefit to this to the shareholder with respect to what they had bargained for. But here's the problem. That actually worked out okay because the court said it was ambiguous when these two clauses conflict, right? But there's other law out there that says that it isn't ambiguous, that the no third-party beneficiary clause actually trumps. Just a couple of quotes. Courts applying New York law have consistently found that even where a contract expressly sets forth obligations to specific individuals or categories of individuals, those individuals do not have standing to enforce those obligations by suing as a third-party beneficiary when the contract contains a negating clause. A negating clause is a no third-party beneficiary clause. And here's another one, where a provision in a contract expressly negates enforcement by third parties, that provision is controlling. So what should you do? Okay, it's okay to have a no third-party beneficiary clause, even though you probably don't need them as badly as you think you do. But you need to accept out provisions in the agreement that are intended to benefit third parties. And those provisions can be things like indemnification clauses that go beyond the parties to the contract, that actually indemnify subsidiaries and affiliates and officers and directors. Those are not parties to the contract. If you intend to benefit them, you might find yourself in a situation where you've just excluded them by your no third-party beneficiary clause. Now, here's a more elaborate one that I pulled off the PLI with respect to mergers and acquisitions, and that clause has all kinds of carve-outs with respect to it, and it's a very thoughtful clause. There's a lot of things in it. I just throw it out there as something to look at, but be careful out there. Don't let your no third-party beneficiary clause just sort of stay out there in the netherworld and potentially defeat something specific that you did intend third parties to have. And these third parties may be people on your side of the table. Okay, choice of law. Now, I have covered this before, but new law on this just keeps coming out all the time, where there are anomalies in our choice of law clauses that we really haven't thought through. Here's the old standard choice of law clause. This agreement should be governed by and construed in accordance with the laws of whatever. Sounds fine, but it actually doesn't accomplish what you think it accomplishes, at least not completely. There's law all over the country that says that that is not a choice of all the law of the jurisdiction that you've named. It's only the law in some, I think about 50% of the cases across the country or 50% of the states. If you have a clause like that, it only governs the contract itself because it only deals with the contract terms. And so if you have a tort claim, that's open to restatement principles and it has nothing to, and you can't use that choice of law clause to name the contract. The other 50% are to use the contract to get the tort law of that state to apply. In the other 50% of the cases, you can. And so, for example, since a big percentage, as we all know, of cases in dealing with purchase and sale agreements, because people can't help themselves, they'll throw in a contract claim and then they'll throw in negligent misrepresentation, fraud, or anything like that. And when those claims are thrown out there, they aren't necessarily governed by the law that was chosen in the contract. In addition, this is came as a surprise to a lot of transactional lawyers and maybe even some litigation lawyers, through an anomaly in the common law that goes way back, statutes of limitations are procedural, not substantive law.